This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Here, the principal songwriter for the Bloomington Normal pop rock quintet Sherwood Forest tell a tale of a medieval soldier who dies in war.
He's been slain in battle. Basically, the whole song is him mourning the fact that he will not see his beloved.
Clifford Close digs into Sherwood Forest's struggles as well. Plus, Laura Kennedy takes us inside a new art exhibit that involves music influenced by war. Our gardening podcast, Grow, lets us know we're not quite done with gardening for the winter. Sometimes you garden now for the spring. And correspondent Brianna Grow interviews a TEDx Normal speaker about the case for putting out. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Author and speaker Sam Cullinane says when couples feel themselves drifting apart, it's time to get close, really close. GLT correspondent Brianna Groh has this preview of Cullinane's upcoming TEDx Normal Talk, The Case to Put Out.
We are coming up on 24 years of marriage, but in our 10th year of marriage, we signed divorce papers and I moved out of the country for a year. And we ended up getting back together. And I think that's what makes our journey so unique. And since we've been back together, our relationship has just blossomed and grown and gotten better and better and better. And we're like one of the happiest couples we know. I don't want to brag, but we do feel like that.
Sure. So you had a new beginning where it would otherwise have been an ending. In that time that you spent apart, what did you do separately and together that allowed you to launch your relationship again?
I think what happened when we split apart was, you know, I think you get in this habit of thinking that your partner either makes you happy or makes you unhappy. Well, so during our year apart, you know, any stuff that I was bringing to the relationship, I still have that stuff. And I wasn't any more or less happy without him than I was when I was with him. And so to recognize that and also start to see my part in the downfall of the relationship. We also have children. We have two children. They're grown now, but we were always having to work together to, you know, shuttle the kids. Well, and it was a lot of coordination because I was living in Spain and he was living in Utah. And so it was a lot of coordination and a lot of talking and also traveling. So, you know, he would come out to Spain. He came out to Spain a number of times to see the kids. I would also go home. So we were always in contact, and we also recognized, like, we're friends. We're good friends. And not only that, I ran a big team of people out there in Europe. And I tried to date a little bit, but it was awkward. Like, I was the boss there, so I couldn't date anybody I knew in work. And I'm living in Spain. My Spanish is pretty mediocre. So I dated kind of, but, you know, he would be there staying with me in my home and he would seduce me because I was having there was no sexual activity happening in my life at all. And I just realized how comfortable we were together and how maybe I had seen our relationship in a different, you know, in like a kind of a negative way that now started to come to like a nice, a sweet, a comfortable friendship, and still, you know, he could seduce me a little bit.
So there was definitely still something there that could be the basis to build off of.
Yeah.
Your upcoming talk is called The Case to Put Out. First, can you summarize that talk for listeners?
Sure. I know I want to be careful how I say this. I don't want to give it all away, but
of course, yeah.
But in our relationship, Patty and I, we had what we believed was like a a mismatch of libidos. Patty, it seemed like Patty always wanted to have sex. Seems like I never did. And this was a problem. This was a problem. And it, you know, it didn't, to be honest, we still had it even after that 10-year breakup. You know, we got back together, and this was like one of the problems that we couldn't solve. And, you know, when you're in that cycle of someone's always asking and someone's always rejecting the other, it creates tension and resentment. And so this talk is how we worked through that. But also, you know, I got so curious about why what we tried worked so well. And then I started doing all this research about sex and how it works and sexual desire. And so it also includes all of this science that I learned about after getting curious about why this thing that we tried that ended up working and, you know, continues to work in our relationship, why it works so well, our experience.
Yeah, so your book, Bigger Love, that's drawing from your personal experiences. And then you actually have a second book, Marriage from Miserable to Magnificent. And that is sort of, you set out to back up those personal experiences with scientific research. So what can you tell me about what you found?
There's a woman who runs a sex lab up in she's a sex researcher. She has it's called the SHARE Lab. I think it's Sexual Health and Relationships Lab. And her name is Amy News, and it's in Canada. She was doing a series of studies, and she found that 80% of people had this issue with their partner in the past month, and 95% of people had it in the past year, which is nearly all. Statistically speaking, these are very, very high numbers.
Yeah.
And so it's very common. And, you know, we work with couples. We do some couples retreats. We do a little bit of coaching. And we find that this is extremely common. And it is causing, you know, it's causing issues in relationships, even leading up to breakups and divorce.
Wow. And is this more common in long-term relationships?
Well, yes. And I mean, if you look at the science behind, you know, when you fall madly in love, like when you first meet somebody and there's this, the kind of like, we call it the madly in love stage, in our book, we talk about all the different kinds of love and the Greek names. So we call it Eros. So during Eros, when you first meet someone and you have the butterflies and you know, you're thinking about them all the time, your body's flooded with all these hormones. And that creates a lot of sexual desire. When that period ends, which can be anywhere from, you know, scientists from 6 months to like 2 years, when that starts to wane, and or you have big life changes like stress in your relationship, you know, maybe grief, or you have a child, all those things affect those chemicals in your libido.
I'm Brianna Groh. I'm talking with Sam Cullinane. She'll be at TEDx Normal at the ISU Center for Performing Arts November 16th, giving her talk, The Case to Put Out. Okay, so we were talking about this mismatched libido and how it's a pretty prevalent problem, especially for people in long-term relationships. So you've been through this yourself with your husband. What solution are you proposing for couples?
Well, because it's a little bit of a complicated answer, and that is the TED talk.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to just give it away, but essentially what we ended up doing was making an agreement. And this agreement is to choose each other and the love and acceptance of each other and our relationship, and choose to have those be extremely important to us. And that changes the way we make this decision about, you know, whether we say yes or no to each other when either one of us wants to have sex, make love.
I think a lot of couples feel like it's already a sensitive issue. And the idea of approaching it as, we're going to come to some kind of consensus on this, might be scary. So do you talk to couples about how to have this discussion?
Yes, we do. I started developing this program that talks about how to talk about this and things that you can do to make the solution that we propose easier. So, and it has a number of different steps. Like, for example, when it comes to sex, the golden rule is nice, right? Do unto others how you would have them do unto you. Hmm. But the platinum rule is better, which means you do what they want to be done. So a lot of times in sex lives, again, like during that mad love phase, you know, the trying to figure each other out is really fun. But when you're in a longer term relationship, you know, really understanding what turns people on, what turns people off, what really creates arousal. And, you know, it's funny, we talk a lot about what turns people on, but learning what turns people off is as important, if not more important, as learning the turn-ons. So we talk about that. And we talk about the way that you ask. When you're asking, you're not asking as a selfish, you know, I wanna get off, but you're asking to pleasure your partner. And I also hear a lot about couples who use sex as currency, right? Like, if you do this for me, then I'll do this for you, and sex is part of this negotiation. Well, I really discourage that kind of thinking about it, because that connection is really for the relationship. The other thing that we talk about, though, and this will be also in my talk, is sex and having a happy long-term relationship. There, scientifically, that has been correlated very strongly. There's a scientific study that was showing that, you know, you have sexual satisfaction and you have this study was specific to marriage. You have marital satisfaction. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people believe that if you have marital satisfaction, then you will automatically have sexual satisfaction. Well, that isn't what science is starting to show. What the science is showing is if you have a great sex life, however you figure that out, that almost always correlates to having marital satisfaction and stability as well.
Do you have any feelings about why that might be? Is it that it builds intimacy and trust, and that's a foundation for greater communication?
Let's just say in my own relationship. Mm-hmm. I think to get to sex where you're both satisfied and it's pleasurable, you do have to have trust. You do have to have great communication. But also, you know, when you're having sex with your partner, your bodies are flooded with a lot of the same chemicals that happen when you're madly in love. But these hormones, they promote bonding and intimacy. And I feel like, and then, you know, if you can, and if you're doing it enough, that feeling, it creates like a glue, right? I like to, in our relationship, when we aren't having sex, and I mean, it happens, right? We've been apart for 2 weeks. We've both been traveling. So when you're not having sex, you know, you start to feel this kind of distance. And just with that, just being intimate together, it's like it's like a sinking in, you know, suddenly we're, oh, there you are. There I am. There's our relationship. And when we're not doing it, we don't feel that same connection. It, you know, we like our fights are harsher, you know, everything is edgier. But when we are connecting that way, it's like it softens everything else for us. So I think it has to do with the chemicals and the bonding and the intimacy that's created through that act.
Mm. Is there anything else you want to tell listeners about their talk or why they should come listen?
I think they should come listen if they want to enjoy happy, long-term, lasting relationships and are looking for, and even if they're not looking for this solution yet, as we mentioned, it's so common that even if they're not having a problem with it in their relationship now, it could be a problem in the future. And this is just to create a spark of a paradigm shift to help you look at that problem and the solution differently.
That's Sam Cullinane giving us a preview of her upcoming talk, The Case to Put Out, at TEDx Normal at the ISU Center for Performing Arts on November 16th. I'm Brianna Groh.
This year's TEDx Normal event runs from 9 a.m. to noon on the 16th at the ISU Center for the Performing Arts. Ticket information and a full list of speakers can be found online at tedxnormal.net.
WGLT is a service of Illinois State University, ranked in College Factual's top 75 best colleges for the money out of more than 1,500 schools across the country. Illinois State is also among the best bang for the buck colleges in the Midwest, according to Washington Monthly. More at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet. Hello, I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come on the show, you thought you might be done with gardening for the season? Not quite yet. Hear more in our gardening podcast, WGLT's Grow, in just a few minutes. The principal songwriter and lead vocalist for the Bloomington Normal pop rock quintet Sherwood Forest says the group's new EP digs into personal struggles, internal and with family, friends, and lovers. Clifford Close tells WGLT's John Norton the band will give a free concert Saturday night at the Coffee House and Deli in Uptown Normal during a release party for the new EP.
We kind of wanted this EP to be a sort of calming kind of message, like the inner struggle and everyday conflicts of life, I guess.
It's interesting you mentioned calming, because I don't take this as a calm album. I'm hearing a lot of angst and struggle in this. Well, let's start with the single you put out last year ahead of the album. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the song is called Glow. Let's play a little bit of this.
I'm getting sick and tired of leaving.
Okay, so there's basically the first verse, and then you continue, what do I want for me?
What do I want for me?
I want a glow for you to see.
Oh, I want a glow for you to see.
So this song is actually a very personal song, addressing my desire to be better for my family. My family's gone through struggles, and I've always had that, inner conflict of, you know, is there anything that I can do? What, in what way can I be better for the ones that I love in order to help things out?
No, I've got a change for us to be free.
Have you played this for your family?
I'm not sure if I've been very explicit about it, probably because around the time that I wrote this song, there were some issues being dealt with, and so maybe I didn't want to bring that right out at the moment, but I have no problem with them knowing that now, and I know they've heard the song and they like it. Maybe they've read between the lines, but...
Well, they'll won't have to read between the lines if they're listening anymore, right?
Right, yeah.
The name of the song is Glow. It's from the new Sherwood Forest EP, Still My Soul. This is WGLT's Sound Ideas. I just want to say for the record, this is a phenomenal EP.
Thank you.
This is really good. And the song Glow itself, it's the obvious single if there was a single from the album. Not that the rest of the songs aren't fantastic. Are you guys giving any thought to touring?
You know, we've...
This is as good. Glow is as good as anything that was out there in 2018. And I'm serious.
Well, thank you. Touring has always been a dream for me, and I'm always open to it, but only when it'll work out for all of us and for the benefit of the band.
Let's move on to the song Infinem.
My eyes roll up
they search for your face in the dying light. My mind fades away, but my heart will not give in.
A couple of the lines that jumped out at me: but my heart will not give in, the smile of my enemy is not what I wish to see.
So I wrote this song a long time ago. It was actually part of the Sherwood Forest's first release that we ever did.
Oh.
It was very different. We decided to revamp it. It went from like a folk song to an 80s inspired kind of rock song. Most of my songs are very personal, but there are other songs where I'm actually writing a story. This story is about a soldier, medieval times or something, who has gone off to war, and he's been slain in battle. Basically, the whole song is him mourning the fact that he will not see his beloved, who is all the way at home. And so to answer your question, his enemy who has stabbed him in the heart, I wish I could say that it was metaphorical for something, but not really.
It's like a fantasy thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Name of the song, Infinem, on WGLT's Sound Ideas, Still My Soul, the new EP from Sherwood Forest. Clifford Close, principal songwriter and one of the band members in the studio with us. Warren is the next song I want to play here.
I swear that I'll try if I have some more time, but we might as well drink some more tea as I sing. I'm still trying to work.
To my ears, it's sort of a little nod at what we talked about previously, kind of an old Irish jig or maybe a English folk song or something like that. You had to go there, right?
Yeah. I'm very proud of this EP. However, I am very aware that this is a mixture of a lot of different styles. No matter how hard we try, we can never get away from that initial folk sound that we originally started out with. I will say that I was definitely very inspired by some 60s, 70s folk like Bob Dylan, Simon and Garfunkel with this one. In fact, originally what we had in mind was that it was going to be purely acoustic, but to kind of fit it more with the other songs, we added a bit more synth and a bit more, a few more instrumentations.
I've been trying to work out the rest.
So the name of the song is Warren from the new Sherwood Forest album. Mumford & Sons, Dawes, Jars of Clay, some of the groups that are on your Facebook page's influences, and we've talked about specifically Mumford & Sons and maybe Dawes. Do you feel as you evolve and keep making new music that you are developing your own sound now, or your own sound is becoming more clear?
I think so. Even though, like I said, this EP is definitely a mixture of different sounds, I think we're finally getting to the point where we can write a song and we can be like, oh yeah, this is a Sherwood Forest song.
Well, let's finish with Sarcasms.
Yeah.
Really cool song. Lyrically, the writer is deeply ambivalent about a relationship with someone they respect deeply.
I wrote this song, it was kind of built out of frustrations that I've had with relationships with people and with communicating with people. I mean, it's literally in the title, Sarcasms, how it can be difficult when, especially with people that feel very strongly about in my life, and like every interaction is just some sort of like sarcastic conversation or whatever. But deep down inside, I'm like, oh no, I want to have like genuine conversation here. I want to say how I really feel, and I want you to say how you really feel. I guess that's always sort of been like a defense mechanism.
I guess it's some kind of phantasm to dream of holding your chin. Let's dispense with all kinds of sarcasms, considering the state that I'm in. Nothing's like the truth from your mouth.
Well, and the other part of the song is toward the end when it kicks into another gear. It's almost like you've got a chorus.
Yeah.
And musically it kicks up a notch. This is just cool.
Well, I guess when I recorded the original demo to play for the guys, I always knew I wanted the song to like end with a bang. I've always been a fan of climactic endings. We did some gang vocals and we had some heavy electric guitar in there that wasn't really in there previously in the song, and all of a sudden it just comes out of nowhere. I knew I also wanted some strings, but none of us play violin or anything, but Nick Statina connected us with Jinty McTavish, shout out. She did all the string parts on her own. She just layered everything to just sound like an orchestra. It gives me chills almost every time that I listen to it.
Well, I was cheering at the end of the song, and I'm like, yes! Well, Clifford Close, it's great to talk to you about the new EP. Yeah. It's called Steal My Soul from Sherwood Forest. Congrats on a great album.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sherwood Forest principal songwriter and lead vocalist Clifford Close speaking with WGLT's John Norton. The band has a release party for their new EP, Still My Soul, Saturday night at the Coffee House and Deli in Uptown that includes a free Sherwood Forest concert. As we listen to more Sherwood Forest, discover local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app.
Don't tell me that you hate me.
Rafael Sadiq is one of the most influential musicians in R&B in the last 30 years. From his production credits with John Legend and Solange to fronting Tony, his latest album is called Jimmy Lee. We'll talk about it and the time he went on tour with Prince in Japan. Pretty cool. It's Rafael Sadiq on an encore edition of World Cafe.
You can hear World Cafe 7 to 9 tonight on WGLT and WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from 1107 Optique at Vision Point Eye Center, offering nearly 2,000 eyewear frames from simple to sensational by today's most fashion-forward designers. Clearly original options available on-site at 1107 Airport Road in Bloomington or online at visionpointeye.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, how war hurts musical composers and how that shows up in their music. Laura Kennedy has a sample from a new art exhibit. We have already had a little snow, but gardening is not quite done for the year. In this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow, WGLT's Mike McCurdy and Illinois State University's Patrick Murphy share tips on how to start now on next year's garden beauty and what not to do.
Fall is the best time to plant trees, woody plants, bulbs, and recently divided plants, and even turf and seed grass. Here to tell us more in this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow, is our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. I'm Mike McCurdy. Murph, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Like with everything, I assume there are exceptions to the rule that fall is a good time to transplant.
Yeah, there is such thing as kind of a point of diminishing returns for the fall planting season. And if we reference some of the experts from the extension at Purdue University, some plants are more susceptible to winter injury during fall planting. So these plants include magnolia, dogwood, the native tulip tree, birch, beeches, a whole slew of plants are included.
And why is that?
A lot of those plants, they need the root growth to establish themselves before the growing season has actually ended. So if you wait real late, like right now, it might be too late because we've got the snow and the cold and it's not going to be real warm afterwards. So when the new plant goes in the ground, the leaves stop producing chlorophyll, the roots are not growing, and the plant will just sit in the hole and freeze all winter.
But for the most part, tree planting in the fall is good. That's because of root growth?
That's correct. For all of the plants in the categories you mentioned, Mike, that root growth establishment is the greatest during the cool season temperatures, and that longest period of those temperatures is in the fall.
So what's going on underground with the roots when the temperatures are a little cooler?
Well, when the soil temperatures are in the 50s, let's say, because that's the temperature that the spring planting season begins with. When the forsythias bloom, that's a good indication that the soil temperatures are great for planting. But in the fall, the plants are still growing coming out of the summer planting season. And as the leaves stop producing chlorophyll and the plant is still working, the roots move out of the root ball and into the planting site. And that's what you're looking for. That's what'll keep you out of trouble moving into the winter.
So what about other plants and even woody plants?
Late season plantings of particularly things like azalea, rhododendron, magnolias, dogwoods, these are all spring blooming plants, by the way. These perennials and woody plants can decline and fail when they're planted too late in the fall or in the fall at all, because a lot of these plants that I mentioned are very slow growers. So lack of root establishment allows the crowns to dry out, and that's the part of the plant that's just above the soil line. And then when that part dries out, you can have damage and failure. And when you're adding your newly divided perennials, watering and mulching them is really important for this reason.
I always like dividing hostas. One, you're getting two plants for the price of one, or even more if you continue to divide them over time. Because even in the first season of dividing that hosta, it comes out and those fronds come out and sort of drape back over like a fountain. You can't tell it's a transplant.
I know, and that's a great way of kind of illustrating how pruning can stimulate growth, because dividing a perennial, you dig up a hosta that's the size of a garbage can lid, you could cut it into four hostas. You don't have to just slice it in half. So I agree with what you're saying. And you're pruning those roots when you're dividing that hosta, and that's why you see that flush of growth.
Daylilies, I've had success doing that. I've never lost a daylily dividing it in the spring.
They're so tough. They're great for that.
I always plant bulbs in the fall, even garlic. What do you think about that?
Tulip bulbs are best planted in October, and the ideal time to plant the daffodils and other spring flowering bulbs is kind of fits into that time frame as well. You want to plant the bulbs in groups or clusters to achieve the maximum visual impact. Masses of color are more recognizable. And also the plants kind of nurse each other in this little grouping there. So that's a little different than the garlic and such, because you can plant that in isolation. Because garlic, you're going to consume it, right? You might enjoy the flowers for a very short period of time, but I think the time frame, you're still in good shape.
And it's still essentially a bulb.
It absolutely.
So I never really paid much attention to the month that I was supposed to plant the bulb, because I had to garden when I had the time to do it. So I would just treat fall as one big season, but I never had any bad luck with planting bulbs sort of, throughout the fall season, and I've planted garlic as late as November.
And I've planted tulips. I've drilled tulips into the ground during the month of December before when we had very mild winters, and the ground did not freeze all the way up until, say, like Christmas time, and I didn't lose a single bulb, nor did the squirrels get all of them. But it's some of the plants that we're talking about, particularly those spring bloomers, those are the ones that you got to watch for as far as planting them too late in the fall.
So what is your favorite bulb and flower?
I think allium is my favorite
Mine
bulb.
Mine too. I love the giant globe alliums. They're so impressive and make such a statement in the garden.
I love that shape and that color. I'm personally fond of the violets, so the purples and the blues and stuff. But allium is a lasting flower as well, and you can get it in any size you want. You can get it knee high, or you can get it chest high, and it's tough as nails. My practice years of experience in Chicago and Northern Illinois, if you go to the city of Chicago and any of the northern suburbs, allium is always something that's part of the public planting display because it's so reliable and it's tough as nails.
And I would occasionally divide those and daffodils as well. I would go back in and dig those up and then split because they will reproduce their own bulbs.
Yeah, I wonder, we should sometimes do an experiment or something to see, like if you started with, say, 3 daffodils and you divided them every year, how many square foot would the initial planting turn into after a couple years? Because it's almost like it's part of the program. If you don't do that, you start to get a decline in your flowering.
What about the Great American Lawn? I assume, is it good or bad to seed and turf in the fall?
Seeding is literally the best way to produce a wonderful yard. It's a wonderful stand of grass. It's not so much the fertilizing and everything. For the same reasons that woody plants and trees love fall planting, grass roots love that cool soil temperature also. Sod can establish very quickly during the fall months. As soon as you start creeping up on that first hard frost and the eve of Indian summer, that's when you got to kind of start being conservative about sodding and seeding. The sod could lay there with no root development and literally freeze to the ground. That sod may not be viable in the spring.
You might have a square dead patch.
You might. Or you have a spot where the weeds have come up through a poorly established section of sod. Grass, on the other hand, is a little more forgiving because there is such thing as frost seeding, and we may have even talked about it before. So if you've got a bunch of grass seed laying around in your garage and you've already conducted your last mow of the season, it's really not that wasteful to go ahead and throw it out on the ground. The snow will help that grass seed come in contact with the earth. If you can sow that grass seed on some bare soil and make sure that the grass seed has just a little bit of soil cover on it, it will for sure germinate in the following spring.
And not only is fall a good time for that, I would assume, because of the temperatures, but we also get a little more moisture.
You get some more moisture, and you might have a spot in your property or your garden that is shaded for most of the year, and then you get a small window of opportunity in the early spring and in the late fall when those leaves are gone and more of that sunlight's hitting the ground. Sometimes that extra week of sun is all you need to launch off your new turf seed planting.
But with turf seed or turf itself, water is important.
Absolutely.
The same with transplants.
That's right.
If you have any gardening or landscape questions, get in touch. You can share your questions and we might answer them on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
You can subscribe to this podcast and our daily news podcast, The Leadoff, at wglt.org.
Support for WGLT's Grow comes from FS Custom Turf by Evergreen FS. FS Custom Turf includes a team of specialists, including a certified turf specialist and a tree doctor to care for yards and trees. Products and services detailed at evergreen-fs.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A collaborative arts event highlights the music and art created in the devastation of the World War, in the wake of the devastation of World War I. Their performance features some rarely heard music that touches on the profound creative influence of the war to end all wars. WGLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
University Galleries in Normal hosts a unique concert event in honor of Veterans Day, showcasing how World War I impacted a generation of composers and artists. Broken Harmony, Reconstructing Art is Friday, November 8th at 6:30 p.m. It features pianist Jason Terry and soprano Angela Yoon, who are performing amidst artwork curated by Jessica Benjamin and her husband, Alfonso. Terry says he was initially considering a commemorative solo piano recital, but quickly realized that this was a project that called for collaboration, and so invited his wife Yoon to join him.
And we started thinking outside the bag and decided we wanted to incorporate visual artists as well.
So that is where Jessica Benjamin and her husband come into play.
So I was actually at Bradley University, and I did not know them. I was just searching for local artists on schools that were around's website, and her name popped up, and just reading her bio, it seemed like someone that might be willing and of interest to collaborate with. So I reached out to her. We talked on the phone. I just dry called her and told her exactly what I was thinking. She was receptive to the idea, and coincidentally, her husband Alfonso was working at Bradley University as well, and I had never met him. So he and I met, and the rest is history, so they say.
So when you decided to start collaborating, where did you find the material that you wanted to include? Did you have to do a great deal of research?
I had done a lot of research on my own for strictly piano solo repertoire, and I had spent several months looking and scouring music that I thought could pair well showing before and after the war. When Angela got involved, she can talk about what she was doing on the vocal lit side, but I would say both of us spent several months actually thinking and considering and changing and altering. Even after we first met with Jessica, we still didn't have our repertoire set completely, and she was gracious and allowed us to change stuff up until a few months ago.
So we started with some idea about it, and we started researching based off of that. But a lot of the repertoire decision was made after we've done a lot of research, and it came, I think last edition was Saint-Saëns, the Hymn to the Peace. And that one we found at the very, very last moment. Jason had to arrange a trumpet part to it that didn't really exist. It existed as an orchestra score, but that score does not exist anymore. So we had to be creative and think about a possible way to make this happen.
Let's talk about some of the things that informed your decisions, Jason, Angela, when you were looking at pieces to perform. Were you thinking about these needed to come from artists who were actually on the front lines, experiencing things, maybe composing while they were on the front lines, bringing it back and performing it for people? Or were you looking at people who were, you know, stuck on the home front and, you know, dealing with the heartbreak and the anxiety of it and doing their compositions there? Were you looking for a particular type of artist's experience?
I think it's both of what you suggested. Some composers, for example, like Erik Satie, his music changed so drastically, and it never returned the same as how it used to be before the war. Their musical color has been affected so much, it changed their entire style or approach to music. So that's why we chose certain composers. And certain composers we chose because it was appropriate. They created repertoires that was in reaction to the war.
There is kind of a wide variety of pieces, composers, and why we picked those. There's some pieces, for example, Scott Joplin, his Maple Leaf Rag is going to be on the concert, and that clearly wasn't affected by the war since it was written almost 20 years before. But Igor Stravinsky's piano rag music, he claims, was influenced because of the Harlem Hellfighters coming over from the U.S. as soldiers, bringing the ragtime music with them, which he obtained that way. Angela mentioned Satie, heavily influenced by it. Another piano one that I'm looking at is Maurice Ravel. We know that Ravel was an ambulance driver in the war and wrote a nice piano set after the war that he dedicated to six friends of his that had been killed in action. There's a wide gamut that we're going to explore in this concert. We know that Sanson at the time had already officially retired from the concert stage, but after the war started in 1914, he went back to the concert stage, and this was one of his last pieces he ever composed. I think it's Opus 159, if I remember correctly, after the completion of the war was over, and he composed it in 1919, just about 18 months before he passed away.
So much of the music that came out of that time answered certain needs with the composers and with the audience as well. The need to mourn, the need to celebrate, to raise spirits, and to commemorate as well as we moved beyond the war. Were you choosing songs and pieces that would reflect these different ways of expressing and reasons of expressing?
I think some of them are definitely representational of what the composer wanted at the time as far as what he or she wanted it to say to the audience. But a good number of them, I'll refer back to the Sanson that we mentioned already, as well as the Kurt Weill that we're performing. As far as we know, these pieces have never really been performed. The Kurt Weill, we found out, we received the manuscript copy from the Kurt Weill Music Foundation, and they told us that after Kurt Weill himself premiered the piece, the score was put away and it has not been published to date. And the same thing with the Sanson. We found that one actually in a bibliography that we have not found a score other than a piano arrangement, but we know that Sanson orchestrated it. But by all accounts, it's never been performed, and we've not even been able to find a manuscript of the orchestration at this point. So it's been interesting to find these pieces that were written as a direct reaction, but perhaps never received their intended purpose.
Did you find a lot of differences between, essentially, both sides of the war, between the American and the English composers, the French composers, and then the German composers? Was there a lot of difference, or were there a lot of things that really overlapped, that they had a lot in common, even though they were fighting on different sides, they were expressing the same things?
I would say definitely there are some similarities. Darker. After the war, it's somber, darker, confused, out of ordinary sounding. Those are the things that I've noticed. It's just not the normal chords, harmonic structure. It's not the normal melodic structure musically. That doesn't really make sense.
After the war, it seems to cross nationalities, cross ethnicities, that everyone was affected, whether they were on the winning side or the losing side.
Everybody seems to have been utterly unsettled and really wasn't sure. The confusion was coming through in the music.
I think overall that would be my take on it. I will say an interesting quote by Maurice Ravel, his piece that he wrote that is in honor of two brothers that were killed by a bomb that I'll be performing. He says he got in trouble because it wasn't sad enough sounding, and his response was, "The dead are sad enough." So for him, it wasn't really making sad music. It was making some kind of music in honor of his friends, maybe more so than just the fact that there was a war that changed life forever.
Jason, Angela, was there anything that you found in your research that really surprised you about the music of that era?
In general, particularly in academic circles, music at the turn of the century, particularly when we get to atonal and Schoenberg and later with 12-tone and serialism, it's often relegated to the back burner, and it's it's not even considered music in some circles just because they say, oh, this is too mathematical, it's too formulaic, we don't want to listen to this. But I would say for me, spending this last 18 months with this style of music, it's been a learning experience for me to see how much music there actually is underneath all the surface. And when you understand the context that some of these composers had either witnessed or at least read about in primary sources of the newspaper of the day, it makes the music a little more sensible.
That's pianist Jason Terry and soprano Angela Yoon. Broken Harmony, Reconstructing Art is Friday at 6:30 p.m. in University Galleries in Normal. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The creators of Broken Harmony, Reconstructing Art have hopes for the future of the event as well. You can hear more about that in bonus audio at our website, wglt.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from John Norton, Laura Kennedy, Mike McCurdy, and Brianna Groh. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.